Hey y'all, this is Lisa Adkins on Agile Uprising.
Hey, hello, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm Andy Claff, and I'm joined by my fellow board members, Chris Merman and Andrew Leff, not to be confused with Andrew Claff. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Hey.
And it's our pleasure to welcome yet another recovering project manager to the Agile Uprising podcast, Miss Lisa Adkins. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me, guys. Hello, everyone who's listening to this.
She's really a reform project manager?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was a PMO director.
Whoa. Yeah. I don't know you from that life. That doesn't seem like life that I would know you from.
Well, you know, there are people in my hometown of Richmond, Virginia, who do know me from that life, and now they know me in the Agile world, and they will tell people, oh, no, you would not even believe what she was like before. She's a totally different person.
We have to find some of these people and drag some stories out of them. That might be another podcast.
Give us an example of how you've changed since then.
Well, you know, when I was a plan-driven project manager, people really were resources, and I didn't necessarily see a better way to do things. In fact, if I treated people like people, then it would be really hard to, you know, get them to do stuff according to this plan that, you know, I made them give me at the beginning of this project. So now I can look back and see kind of how inhumane that whole thing is, but at the time it didn't seem that way to me. It just seemed like, well, this is what we have to do to get stuff done.
There was no like Virginia charm or anything that you could throw at them?
Oh, there was plenty of charm, which is why they continued to want to work with me as a project manager, even though, you know, it was like, what would they say? They would say it's the iron fist wrapped in the velvet glove. Seriously. Yeah, because I can connect with people pretty quickly. It was always really easy for me to manipulate people, which sounds awful now. You know, and I would have never said it then. But if I look back at what I was really doing, that was kind of it in a nutshell. Wow. True confessions in the first 2 minutes. Whoa.
All right. So now I'm curious about this, because I think we all know what this feels like, what that manipulation feels like. But I'm curious, when you kind of had that realization after the fact, I'm curious what that realization was like for you.
It was about a period of maybe 6 or 8 months in 2009, 2010. This is just as the Coaching Agile Teams book is about to come out, where I started to really get in touch with how much of a kind of a karmic debt I had racked up. And it was like going into the pit of despair for months. And I was in a really intense leadership program at the time. It was a year-long program, and the leaders of that program helped me move through it, but it was a tough time.
Mm. Now that's not an insignificant amount of time.
No, it's not. It's not. And I mean, it's really hard when I look back at all the ways I was interacting with people in the workplace. And I think about the divorces that happened during my tenure as a plan-driven project manager and a PMO director. I think about like the consultant who I made stay the weekend, even though he told me like he really can't, he's got to get home to his wife. You know, just think about the toll that it took. Now, I'm not claiming full responsibility for like any of those things that happened in people's lives, but I certainly know that the way I was working and the way I was demanding that they work was part of it.
Can you dial back to that transformation period and those people that coached you through? What were some of the things that helped you break that, take off that velvet glove, see the iron hand underneath and say, there might be a better way?
Well, see, all of that happened earlier than me getting kind of in touch with this karmic debt. So all of that happened when I just bumped into Scrum by chance in 2004, 2005 timeframe. And what helped me take off that that iron fist was some really good mentoring I got from people at Capital One. That was my first gig as a Scrum Master. You know, I arrived there as a project manager thinking I'm going to do project manager kind of stuff like I'd been doing the previous 15 years. And they were like, oh, we're going to do Scrum. And I'm like, I don't know, that sounds nasty to me, but okay, fine. And it was, Scrum was amazing. It was, Scrum was the, like, the fact that I could see within the first month that people really are actually quite smart and creative and resourceful. And they could produce stuff in a month that in my previous way of working would have taken months or even a, like a year to generate in some cases. So I could see the incredible benefit of it. And then I just didn't see how I was standing in my own way of helping people get that benefit. And I had a great mentor at the time, Mike Vizdos, and he just kept saying, you're doing it again, you're doing it again. See, you're trying to manipulate them. And I just so didn't know how many times I was doing that in a given day. And without having him there to catch me in the moment, I'm not sure I would have moved quite as quickly through that as I feel like I did.
Do you ever find yourself in a situation where that old behavior is just below the surface?
All the time. Yeah, like I have an incredibly strong will and I have a very quick mind. And so those two things together are a real danger because I can, almost in any situation, I'll listen for a little while and I'll see a way to go. I will see a way to go. And if I have something invested in it, like I really want it to go this certain way, I can feel that, you know, that controlling behavior start to come back again.
Like you're going to hammer it home somewhere or other, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Now I don't often, more often than not see that and go, oh, okay, well that's my old friend, you know, but I don't need to pay attention to that old friend because you know what I'm in this world for is to really kind of help other people find their way forward. And it so turns out that my way forward is only like 1% of the time the same as their way forward. So it just, you know, it just doesn't help for me to put my way forward most of the time.
So how did you, this is Andrew Leff, not Andy Clef. Sometimes we get confused.
It's a
podcast.
Different voice. No, I totally hear the difference.
We get complaints though that people on the podcast can't hear it. So
I'm
sorry, I don't mean to keep
that's
announcing my name.
Completely but, different.
All right, pipe down. So how do you get that in like that mindset to go viral? Right. So as coaches, mm-hmm. it's one of the things I tend to struggle with is, yeah, you start to see people working different. You start to see people interacting different. But to get that to go viral throughout the organization, is there any, I don't know, there's no silver bullet, right? But what have you seen been to be successful in that effort, if you have?
Well, I think what helped me, and I think where I see it work the best, is where there's actually some Agile success. So where we bring Agile in and there's even localized success, and we all go, whoa, wow, look at this. This would have never happened in our old way of working. And then all of a sudden, it's just really easy to start looking at the deeper aspects of Agile, kind of what makes it work, you know, how can we have more of this? And my concern is that most people, especially as Agile has crossed the chasm and is getting practice in huge organizations, most people haven't seen an Agile success.
That's a great point.
And so like without that, so I got that infusion of, oh my God, this is so much better. You know, I totally don't know how to do it yet. And I totally don't know how to coach teams yet. I'm talking about like 2004, 2005, but I need to learn because this is the workplace with results and humanity.
So all right, you just said results and humanity. I wonder about humanity without results. Mm-hmm. That doesn't quite seem so happy-go-lucky, right? But there are moments of that, right? So like, for example, there was a tremendous amount of humanity where you were talking about that pit you were in, right? For months. And yet that humanity, I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want to presuppose to anything, but like, it's probably sounds like it turned something on that kind of became the genesis of the next stage of your career to a degree, right? So that humanity almost seems like, regardless of whether there's, I mean, the humanity without the success, it almost seems like it can be just as much of a turning point as with success, right?
When you say no results, Chris, I'm curious if you mean a vacuum or you mean failure. And then I want to toss this, I also want to toss it to Lisa. Was there an, you know, a catalytic event that made you awaken to say, this fist approach isn't working? Like, did you have some great failure where you said, I got to try something different?
No, I thought it worked beautifully. That's the insidious thing about it. I thought it worked beautifully, and it wasn't until I encountered Scrum that I'm like, oh my God, I have actually been the problem in them not delivering results. It hasn't been them this whole time. It's been me.
Wow.
So like that's the catalytic moment, is realizing that I was the one that was standing in my own way from the thing that I really said I wanted, which was for them to be creative and resourceful and have these great results. And I realized we stepped all over what we were talking about earlier, because we asked a question about no results. And so I'm not sure if I'm on target for where we were headed.
I think we were. I guess I was more going after like, so maybe you don't have the, when you said results, I heard success, right? So maybe like there's not success, but there is humanity, right? So.
Well, you know, that's nice, but in a corporation that is traded on Wall Street, humanity is not part of the bottom line calculation. So as we have organizations that are more mindful and our value system goes beyond the bottom line calculation, I think that value system starts to play. And what we were talking about just prior to that is places where Agile is being practiced now, especially these large corporations, unless it can be monetized, most large corporations that are publicly traded, yeah, humanity, shamanity, like, you know, as long as I can get the result. And I don't know if they're going to be allowed to live that much longer with that point of view, but they're certainly alive now.
There's a certain amount of inertia behind many of these corporations that it's going to keep them rolling, I'm sure, for decades.
Well, I think the good news is that many of us, and actually, if I think about my daughter, who's 20 years old, like that generation, they're coming into the workplace with the idea that they're there to grow. The workplace should align with their purpose. You know, it's much more of a values-driven mindset that generation has than mine did coming into the workforce for the first time.
Values-driven and maybe also fulfillment. There's a sense of happiness that this generation strives for in the workplace, which is something new.
So my daughter at 20 already has all kinds of skills that honestly we teach people in our Agile coaching curriculum today. She already has them. So, you know, I'm hoping that these kind of human relationship skills, these self-management skills, you know, meditation is one of the ways to help increase self-management. Like, she's got that stuff already.
So if we take a radical turn in line with what you're talking about, do you think that your daughter's generation, the way that they were raised, the parenting is different, the schooling is different, which lends itself to a different working pattern? Or do you think it's just the inertia, as Andy put it?
Well, I've been studying a lot in the last couple years about adult human development and societal evolution in general. So how those things go together. And this generation of young adults is faced with much larger planetary systemic challenges than was my generation coming out of college. And so I don't know if it was just the way they were raised. It certainly has a lot to do with it. I mean, the affluence of the Western world has allowed them to not necessarily worry about where's my next meal. I mean, obviously you can't get to these higher forms of high concept thinking if you're worried about, you know, is there a bomb coming through my window or where am I going to eat next? But also the challenges of our world are so much greater. And I think the challenges of our world call us forth to a new, more complex level of thinking. And I think that's what these kids are exhibiting.
Plus one, what Lisa's saying is at my last client, I did a like a one-day Agile boot camp for all new employees, and then in the summertime I did it for summer interns. And there's an exercise where we watch Daniel Pink's you know autonomy, mastery, purpose video, and then we do a constellation exercise of which one do you identify with. And I do it with these, you know, middle-aged folks, and they kind of get it, but they don't really know how to talk about it. Meanwhile, the summer interns are completely delving into who they are, and they're like, well, I believe that I enjoy autonomy, but I believe that autonomy is my purpose, and that makes me want to master it more, kind of a thing, so I can maintain my autonomy wherever. And like, they're getting the they're getting the whole takeaways of the exercise before I can even get to it. Meanwhile, the previous generation or two are more while going, mm-hmm. like, what is this for again? Like, why am I talking about what drives me? They get it naturally.
Yeah, you know, I remember teaching a CSM certified Scrum Master class, like, oh, this was like 2008 or something. And it was to a bunch of Wall Street traders. Like, these guys were, I can't remember what they were trading, but they were like mover and shaker kind of guys. And it was almost all men. Maybe there was one woman in the room. And so, you know, I'm at my CSM class, like in the first morning, and this is the part where I talk about how waterfall didn't necessarily suit all the situations it was applied to, how agile is better. And they're like, what's waterfall? And so I start to explain it, and I'm not even 3 minutes in, and they're like, you can stop. That's ridiculous. Like, they're like, that's ridiculous. That would never work in our world. Things change too rapidly. We need to be able to sense and response. Are you going to teach us about that? And I'm like, yeah. So let's just skip the next little bit.
Wow.
They're kind of ahead that way. Like, they get that they're working in a complex world. And our previous ways and our big processes are all, you know, geared toward, at best, a complicated system, but in most cases, like a really simple system that they're just totally unwieldy for.
You said a term that so we can clarify for audience that's not clear, since we are talking about mindfulness to a degree. If someone has never heard the phrase before, Lisa, how would you describe what sense and respond is? Like, it just kind of a layman's terms in everyday workplace. Like, how would you describe that today?
A sense and respond capability would allow one to make the best plan possible given the information available, and all the time monitor how things are going and change the plan and continue to monitor and change. And so people who are in a sense and respond mode are going to make their plans but not believe them.
Emphasis on the sense piece of it.
Think about sensing instead of making sense. We're going to be sensing all the time and figuring out what that information is telling us about how we need to respond. And respond means changing what we thought before.
Well, and talking, for those of us that enjoy doing it. I don't know. I'm probably in that category, right? Mm-hmm. You can't sense if you're the one always talking.
Oh, good point. I mean, actually, so as we come to the idea of mindfulness, I think that mindfulness is actually a key training ground, kind of practice ground for the type of capability we need in people in the future. And I think that at least some of my daughter's generation already have. Well, like my kid, when she gets upset, she goes and meditates.
I'm wondering if that's generational or just how we parent. So I have daughters that sit with me as well, and they just do it because there's cushions and there's dad, and it's 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, the fire's going. So we sit and we get up and do our day. I want to come back to something that you talked about, Merm. Speaking and listening, I think, are both present in a mindfulness state. You don't have to be totally silent, and you can't be in broadcast mode either, unless that's what the situation calls for.
Maybe that's a bias that I show towards talking, because when I, like, if I think of sense and respond, I think of the kind of communication I have. And most of the time, the communication I have is in the respond mode, like thinking about a coaching type. And I know that there are several stances. As someone who knows all the stances, what's with this? I guess that's my bias, is I think of speaking, and I think that I'm speaking in a responsive mode, and maybe that's something I need to work on.
You know, I'm just now sinking into more receptivity, because Chris, what you're making me realize is that I am often speaking and putting forth my ideas. This is part of having that strong will, like I want to be heard. And what I'm learning, I'm in a really intense program for 9 months called, yet another one, called Integral Facilitation Certification. And that's one of the main models here, is penetrative versus receptive energy. And I have a lot of penetrative energy. It's like, I really have a lot of ideas. I want people to hear them. I'm constantly putting forth my point of view. And I've been doing that this whole time in this podcast, I realized.
Well, you're also the guest of honor, so let's give you a little bit of credit.
Well, but here's the deal. Like, we could probably actually deliver more value even if I move into more of a receptive mode, not 100% by any means, but more, that would provide more connective tissue between what we're all saying.
Well, so I identify with what you're saying, because especially in a, so if we're talking about an agile scenario where, whether it's whatever the framework is we're talking about, usually, and Andy and Andrew are similar in this sense, in that when we're in this situation with the client, we're seen as a, I mean, for lack of a better way to put it, regardless of whether we agree with the definition or not, we're an expert, right? So when they want to hear from us, they say, Chris, speak to us, give us the answer. And so we're speaking from a definitive role, right? And that is, to me, again, that's what I think of as responding. They say, here's a scenario, here's a challenge, here is a problem, here is my response, right? And that probably is regardless of whether it, I mean, helps or hinders them, because I've probably done both in my career, that doesn't necessarily help my communication skills in the long run if that's the only stance I take.
Well, let me jump in, Chris. You have a choice how you respond in that situation. And you can choose to respond as the person who's a couple of steps beyond on the path and looking back and saying, you know, here's what I think you should do. You could also choose another stance that is more inquiry. You could also choose one that's challenging. I was in a conversation, God, I think it was on the Coalition site not too long ago, where we were talking about, we have a podcast, Lisa, that was, I think, spur of the moment. I don't know if it was planned. Agile and Music. And we riffed on it, and somebody responded not too long ago about listening to it and really digging it. It reminded me of a strategy that Brian Eno did. He started out writing these oblique questions on the wall in his recording studio, because people, his artists would get stuck and they're in this constrained time box of recording and, oh my God, they're panicking. And he would do these radical things like everybody switch instruments, or play the guitar upside down, or just focus on the space between notes. And it was all these oblique creative strategies. So Chris, I throw that out to you. If your default, if you're recognizing your default and you aren't happy with it, try something else.
Yeah, no, well, you bring up a great point. I mean, I will say that the first time I ever saw Lisa speak was over video conference. She was speaking at a local meetup in Dallas, and she was talking, she gave an abbreviated version of her kind of her conflict resolution kind of workshop that she does, which I'm sure is fantastic. And it's on my list of a million other things I need to get done. But, you know, she talked about curiosity, right? And leading from a sense of curiosity whenever you sense conflict. So I do, you know, as you said that, Andy, I kind of gave myself a little bit of grace to say, okay, you don't always speak from a sense of authority, because you can't always know the answer, right? So, so there is, I think there is room to say, okay, I do make room for that, but I guess, so Andrew hasn't spoken in a while, so let me ask Andrew a question. Andrew, like, I know that you and I have talked about this before. Is there a difference between asking questions and genuinely being curious, and there is and asking questions knowing you're trying to lead them to an answer?
Yeah, and this is always, to me, I always get myself in trouble at the client with this particular situation, just as a simple fact is I put it on them to figure out the answer. I'll help them figure out different things to think about, but I'm not there to give them the answer in my mind. I want them to come up with the answer so they learn how to continue doing this, since, you know, my job's not to be there forever.
Tell me the answer, Andrew.
Which frustrates a lot of the clients that I work with, because their expectation is, yeah, we're paying you to come in and tell us the answer and tell us what to do. And to me, that's, my goal is not to tell them what to do. It's to teach them how to do things differently. So it's a weird balance for me that gets me in trouble.
There are probably ways to get out of trouble with that. But the one thing I'll affirm about what you're saying is I hear you getting in touch with a bigger vision of what you're trying to create there that goes beyond this moment. of them putting you in the box saying, give me the answer. You're saying, no, hang on. I'm trying to create a capability here so that when I'm gone, they can carry on. That's like a golden, beautiful mindfulness moment there. And it probably just happens in a millisecond.
Yeah. And I've never had it called that before. So thank you. But to me, and it's almost, I almost feel irresponsible as a, I even hate to brand myself as a consultant, but as a consultant going into an organization, knowing that I'm not there forever, not to anchor change within the organization to continue the work that we've been doing is almost irresponsible, in my opinion.
I actually had someone from my client team once look at me and say, Chris, I know that you think that we need to get there our own way, but we don't have time for this. Just tell us the answer.
Well, Chris, if you actually have the answer, then it would probably be inhumane to hold it back. I mean, like, so I don't know about you guys, but the more I have helped people discover their own issues, their own blockers, whatever's going on with them, the more I realize that their answer is actually a hell of a lot better than mine. And if I had offered my answer, I would have forever shut down them finding that other pathway. You know, because you can always offer your answer later if you really do think it's going to be useful, but you can never take it back once you've offered it.
That's a great point.
I started practicing this phrase with my current client. I probably heard it somewhere else and stole it, but they say, you know, tell us how we can get going. We're really excited to get going, but we can't waste a lot of time. And I say, well, I know this framework that we're using. You brought me in because I'm an expert in this framework. What I'm not an expert in is you all. You all, how you use this framework is completely unique to the last client I use, which is different from the last client I used before that, and so on and so forth. And so what I need to do is learn you, and I'll never be experts in you, but what we can do is talk together and have an open dialogue, and we'll find the right mix. The few people that I've used that to, they've never, like, they hear it and they go, that makes sense. You don't know it. So let's talk about us. And then we'll talk about how we use this framework in a way that makes sense to us. And they feel better about telling me about themselves then.
Yeah, that's so cool. Because you've already opened the negotiation path, basically. And the negotiation path is that, you know, sometimes you're going to want me to tell you the answer. And guess what? Sometimes I'm not going to have it, right? Or even if I do, if it doesn't make sense to you, it's worthless. Right. And so that helps, at least I hope it would help you be able to step out of the expert box they want to put you in when they try that move.
Yeah. And I kind of like to approach things with teams. And I always find this to be an interesting reaction from them is I try and treat it as we're trying to build a family, you know, just an extended family or a close-knit family. And literally we want to sit down for dinner every day with no technology and actually and talk about our day. And so many people give me like the oddest look. Like, that is such a foreign concept, mm-hmm. right? Like, what do you mean we're going to sit mm-hmm. down? I don't have time to sit down and eat. I got a million things to do. Mm-hmm. But it's so valuable to actually sit in front of people and have a conversation. So it's an interesting, I always find that a little bit comical when I approach it that way, just because people have such an interesting reaction.
That is so sweet. You're reminding me of a moment I had like that. So someone who's a dear friend and a collaborator has been with me now. You know, we've been collaborating together for years now. His name is David Chilcott. And he lives in the Bay Area. And I remember him sitting down with me like, I don't know, like in 2008 or something like that. And he says, Lisa, I don't want to work with anyone I'm not in love with. And I said, that is ridiculous. But here I am, actually, I don't work with anyone that I'm not in love with. And to me, that is so incredibly important. And yet it was the same thing of like when you say to these team members, we're going to be like a family and sit down and talk about our day. It was like that was the same kind of moment that I can imagine some of those team members had, like, what? That's like so out of my way that I even view how the world works. That's just weird.
It's not Disney love, right? It's love in a sense of real heart connection mm-hmm. where you see flaws mm-hmm. in yourself and others and you mm-hmm. accept them and you embrace it and you just show up.
Well, one of my mentors and one of the best coaches I've worked with said something that always stuck out to me. And he always said, you have to touch a heart before you can open a mind.
Mm.
And that was really, really powerful to me is, you know, touching people's hearts to communicate, to get them to think differently is a powerful thing. Like I'm investing in you. So I resonate with the, you know, I fall in love with everyone or I have to be in love with everyone I work with. I get that. I mean, I subscribe to that sort of level of thinking because I'm extremely passionate about what I want to do. I also don't want to beat you over the head with it, right? So to open up someone's heart and find that they're being invested in because you do care about that person can really get a different result from people.
And yourself. It comes back to something that, Lisa, you said earlier in the show. You started to see people as people.
Mm-hmm.
And it opened your heart without looking at them as fungible resources that needed to be optimized, in which case they're just a pair of hands and maybe a mouth to feed. When you recognize they have hearts and you have hearts, you open up a whole nother level of connection, of understanding and power.
Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, guys, I don't think I'd be married without Agile. So, I mean, that was a big shift for me. Agile allowed me to see my now husband in a totally different way. And I don't think I would have ever seen him that way. I don't think I would have fallen in love with him.
That makes me want to get married again.
Well, no, actually, what you should do is have my husband on as well, because we have totally different perspectives on this story.
Agile and marriage. No. She's on to something here, Andy. But the agile marriage, like that's a title in and of itself.
So that, you know, that could be a whole nother show. If this consulting at big corporations didn't work, we could open up the Agile Marriage Therapy Lab.
You know what I will say though to that point is, and we can wrap after this because I know Andy, we're getting on time, but probably one of my favorite teams I've ever been on when I was still working on the team level was a project that went way too long. We were tired of looking at each other. We had spent so much time in a room, so many nights, so many weekends, and we were all there because we all were just, it was kind of what was expected of us kind of a thing. We had done so many nerf fights that someone got shot in the eye and needed to go to the ER. We had an engagement that we had to help plan. We had Christmas presents that we gave to each other, and they were not the fun kind. They were the joke kind that show up on TimeHop on Facebook years later. And then when we got done with the project, two things happened. One, I had a team member pull me in and say, "Hey, I don't know who else to talk to, and I needed to talk to someone." She had tried to take her own life the night before, and she didn't really know what to do about it. She just said, "I need to tell someone, and I felt like I could come to you."
Whew.
And at the same time, we were laughing so hard and like just tears that all we would do is listen to rap music, like just screaming at the top of our lungs. And then when we finished the project, I needed a launch party, and I just said, "I don't know what else to do, so let's just shoot paintballs at each other." So we went paintball shooting. Like that's it. Like that is, and it was 9 months of just pure emotion that didn't start on day one, but it ended in what you would describe, Lisa, as love, right? Like that is, I mean, I don't know what else to describe it from a work perspective. That is love, right? All of that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe another time we can talk about pulling apart intimacy, sex, and power. Because what I'm finding in my own business dealings is when I can pull those apart, I can purely love someone and have an intimate relationship with them. In fact, it's absolutely essential for the kind of creation work I do in the world. But there's no sex and there's no power involved. It's like really clean.
That's a workshop if I ever heard one.
That's the type of stuff I do a ton of reading on, and just I love that type of stuff. I would love to hear more about that. So
that would be a great follow-up show. Well, we are coming up on time. Hopefully we've uncovered some practical, definitely philosophical aspects to Agile and mindfulness. Lisa, I want to give you a couple of minutes to give us some shout outs. What do you have coming up in this new year? What are the best ways for people to get in touch with you?
Well, still through Agile Coaching Institute. I am president emerita of that organization and still teaching that very fine curriculum that actually builds competence in Agile coaching, which I am very proud to say. So yeah, agilecoachinginstitute.com. All kinds of stuff going on there all the time.
Great. And Chris, what do you got cooking in this new year?
Actually, I'm going to be in, I'm actually going to be attending an Agile Coaching Institute class through our friend Haleem in the new year. So I'm excited to take that material in for the first time, Lisa. So we'll see what I get out of that. Probably a ton, more than I can get in 3 days. And you can always find me at chrismerman.com.
Andrew Leff, what's cooking for you?
Not much, just still hanging out at the Uprising. Check us out. I'll also be taking the ACI certs, so I'm actually looking forward to that class.
No way! This is so cool!
Yeah, so it's one of the few certs that I'm very much looking forward to. So, yeah, and you can find me at leanleft.com or, again, on the Uprising. So,
well, thanks, Lisa, for the time.
You're welcome.
Chris and Andrew as well. Thank you also to our listening audience. If you enjoyed this episode, give us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast platform of choice. It really helps other people find
us. Patreon. Don't forget Patreon.
I'll get there. If you'd like to participate in the discussion, join us at coalition.agileuprising.com. And Chris, maybe you'd like to mention Patreon.
He just did.
Would you like to give a little more detail to that?
We love this podcast. We give so much of our life to we want to keep this podcast free and coming. So if you would consider sponsoring us on Patreon, giving us a few dollars a month, we've got some swag that we're offering as a result. So go check us out. What's the URL, Andy?
I'll make sure it's in the show notes.
Yes.
So check them out. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising podcast, signing out. And we are recording. So give us a bumper or two.
I don't even know what bumpers mean.
Oh! That's perfect. So typically we have an intro. Like, what's your favorite radio station? There was this trend of having
NPR. That's pretty much all I listen to is NPR.
Yeah, so NPR doesn't have bumpers. Okay. But for a while, most of the shows were they would have, you know, the latest, greatest recording artist, you know, hello, this is James Taylor.
Yeah. I totally get that. Right. So like, hey y'all, this is Lisa Atkins on Agile Uprising.
With a Texan accent. Like I love it. It's perfect for America. Yeah.
Hey, y'all.
And you could play with it.
Hey, y'all.
Okay.
We accept it.
We accept you, Lisa. We accept you. I live in Dallas.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.